and everything we ever dreamed. Don't you want it?
Maybe.
Can't you see it?
Kinda.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. If you're a regular listener of the show, you'll know that we've often stretched the boundaries of our half-hour time slot, which is officially 11 to 11:30 a.m. When that happens, our KBOO Public Affairs Director, Ender Black, has generously given us a whole hour for the episode. Lately, this has happened with more and more frequency. So again, thanks to Ender, we've taken the plunge and officially gone to an hour slot from 10:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m., same days, the second and fourth Thursdays of the month. I think this gives us a little more room to get to know our guests and for me to indulge my somewhat insatiable curiosity about their work and their lives. I hope you'll continue to be entertained and enlightened, or at least one or the other. On today's episode, the first in our new hour-long time slot, we welcome Scott Nadelson, author of the new novel Trust Me from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Scott's books include the novel Between You and Me, the memoir The Next Scott Nadelson, A Life in Progress, and six collections of short stories, most recently While It Lasts, winner of the Donald L. Jordan Prize for Literary Excellence. Scott's work has appeared in a variety of magazines and literary journals, including Plowshares, Story, The Southern Review, New England Review, Glimmer Train, and The Best American Short Stories. And he's earned a variety of accolades, including the Reform Judaism Fiction Prize, the Great Lakes Colleges Association New Writers Award, and an Oregon Book Award. He teaches at Willamette University, where he's Hallie Brown Ford Chair in Writing, and in the Rainier Writing Workshop MFA program at Pacific Lutheran University. In the words of writer Joe Wilkins, Trust Me is, simply, one of the most affecting novels I've read in years. In the midst of busy days, the book waiting for me on my bedside shelf, I found myself missing these characters, how wise and wounded they are, how silly and confused, how fundamentally human I was hoping for them. Trust Me is a book that will have you hoping for us all. Please join us for our conversation with Scott, which is already in progress. Well, Scott, thanks for dropping by KBOO on this very hot late summer day. Climate change, I guess.
So great to be here. A little smoky outside.
Yeah. Oh, bad air quality, yeah. Too. Now, Scott, you grew up in New Jersey in a Jewish home and attended college at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. My dad actually made a similar move after World War II. You're much older than you, going from a Jewish home in New York City to Chapel Hill, which I always found fascinating. What were your reasons for choosing North Carolina, just to get away?
It was mostly just to get away. I'd be curious to hear your dad's story too. I knew I wanted to go somewhere different, and I felt pretty hemmed in my childhood and adolescence, very suburban kind of place in New Jersey in the 80s, and I just wanted to try something very different. My brother had gone to college at Tulane in New Orleans.
Oh, well,
so
yeah.
I had the South kind of in my view, but I wanted somewhere bigger. And I had heard some good things about Chapel Hill. At the time, I think I was interested in journalism, and they had a good journalism school.
Oh, yeah, it's a very good school.
And so I kind of on a whim, you know, picked that as a spot and went down to visit for a day and loved it. And actually had a class visit with a professor who was teaching Milton, and I'd never heard of Milton. I had no idea anything about Paradise Lost, and he gave a 20-minute little mini lecture on Milton and then a discussion, and he was so riveting that I was like, oh, this seems like a great place.
Now, your time at UNC had a big influence on your career as a writer. You said you came to writing through music, especially the song lyrics, and wanted to be a rock star. Of course, who doesn't?
Right.
What music at the time and songwriters were your role models?
So when I first started listening to music, I mean, seriously, it was in part discovering my father's record collection. And he had, when he was in college, he collected quite a number of LPs, and he had access to a little record store that got radio copies of, you know, so really cheap. He got really cheap vinyl.
What was his taste?
Well, he ranged from show tunes to, you know, folk revival and a lot of stuff that didn't really speak to me at all, but he had the first five Dylan records. And, I mean, and that just was mind blowing for me listening
that
to those.
That was through Blonde on Blonde.
It was huge. It was up to like Rolling Stone. So, yeah.
So a little before that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Just before Blonde on Blonde. Uh-huh. And they were incredible. And it was the first time I heard language in a way that really made sense to me, that spoke to me beyond just the tasks I was meant to do in school. And around the same time, I was listening to some early hip hop stuff like
Grandmaster Flash.
Yeah. Even a little bit later, Public Enemy. And then starting college, I listened to a lot of Tribe Called Quest. And then, so people using language in different ways that really sparked interest and got me thinking about words. And then, and I also was very into New York 70s punk and pre-punk stuff. So Television and the Ramones, and there was a different kind of language. It was just all energy.
Cat in the new novel named Verlaine.
That's right.
Not
that's
after
right.
the poet, but the guitarist
exactly,
in Television.
Because, yeah. My all-time favorite is Television's Marquee Moon. And I love that music from that era and that particular time. It's mysterious and dark and a little gritty and always spoke to me so much. So that was some of the early influence for me, for sure.
Now, given your love of lyrics, you signed up for a poetry class at UNC, but it was full, I read.
That's right.
So you took a fiction writing class instead, and you've said it just really took off from there. I found the thing that I love to do. What do you remember about the class and how it made you feel?
Yeah, it's a great question. I remember that class so well. It was a professor named Bill Henderson. He was a novelist, and he I don't think there was anything particularly special. It was a pretty, you know, ordinary introductory fiction writing class. We studied the, you know, the basics of structure and plot and character. But there was something that happened when I sat down to write. You know, I had been writing poetry, and it wasn't very good, and it was really pretty forced. But somehow I started speaking in the voice of a character, and I came up with this weird little story about a kid who accidentally joins a cult in Philadelphia in the late 80s. And I had spent...
It just kind of came.
I had spent some time in
Philadelphia. So kind of destiny almost.
Yeah, there was something about that space that I was thinking about. And just the voice just carried me and suddenly characters came alive. It was not a good story at all, but it gave me energy in a way that nothing else had.
Do you still have it?
Sometimes, not every day. Yeah. Story. No, God, no. No, I hope it doesn't exist anymore. I wouldn't want to look back
you
at that one.
You don't want scene kind of coming up somewhere.
Yeah.
Or you get blackmailed.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No, there's some bad stuff out there.
Now, you moved from the East Coast, from North Carolina, New Jersey, to Oregon on Labor Day in 1996. So just about 28 years to the day. Right. That's a big move across the country. Why Oregon?
It was, again, wanting something different. So after college, I had spent a year in Europe, lived in Edinburgh in Scotland for half that year. And before I went, my parents, you know, they were kind of pressuring me. You should apply to graduate schools. They wanted me to have some kind of plan. So sort of on a whim, I threw out a bunch of applications to places all west of the Rockies. I'm like, I want to go somewhere new. I love the mountains, and I didn't get to spend enough time in them when I was younger. So I just gave it a shot. And I didn't apply to Oregon State University, which is where I ended up going. I applied to the University of Oregon, but when I was living in Edinburgh, I spoke to my parents on the phone. My father said, "We got a call from somebody from Oregon State University. They want you to come." And I said, "I don't think I applied there."
And yeah, how'd they find out?
As it turned out, they were trying to do a joint program at the time. Oh. U of O had a bunch of poets. OSU had a bunch of fiction writers. They were going to try this joint program. And they basically took anybody who was waitlisted on the U of O program. The OSU folks kind of swiped the applications and made some calls. And so best decision, you know, was best thing that ever happened to me. I got to work with amazing fiction writers at Oregon State. It was a perfect place for me, and I've been here for a long time now.
And after Corvallis, did you move to Portland?
I did move to Portland, yeah. I was in Corvallis for about 3 years and then moved to Portland, and I lived in Portland for about 8 years.
When you came in, we actually talked about some of the clubs, including one, La Luna, which was very close to KABU. It's long since closed down. And the main character in Trust Me actually frequented some of those clubs when he was a young man in Portland, too.
So
some of your background comes out in there.
Yeah, I had Lewis move to Portland. He didn't come out for graduate school. He just came out you know, after college and moved straight to Portland. So he came a little earlier. He came to Portland in 96 when the, the scene was really booming back then, and La Luna was a really big, hot place to see, you know, bands like Hazel and Heat Miser, you know, Elliott Smith's band back in the mid 90s. And, I kind of missed that scene by a couple of years. But I was imagining Lewis really having quite a good time, during that era.
Yeah. I've interviewed, you probably heard of her, Renee Denfeld, a Portland based writer.
I do. And I know her work.
She was in a punk band at the time, and she hung out with people like Courtney Love and, Nirvana. And so what a scene.
Yeah. Great. What an amazing scene. Absolutely.
Now, when you moved here, and ever since, you were struck by the beauty of the landscape in Oregon, a little different than New Jersey, and the vulnerability, especially with our wildfires. You've said that the book, Trust Me, is your love letter to Oregon.
It really is. I mean, I've lived here now, you know, as you said, almost 3 decades, and I've spent so much of my time when I have any space. I head either east or west out of the valley into the hills and spend time under those trees. And I've never gotten over the initial awe. You know, it comes back every time I'm out there. It feels like I'm seeing it all with fresh eyes, and it's never gotten old for me. So this book really was, you know, its initial place coming for me was really thinking about this, the landscape, and thinking about these characters in a space that is somewhat separate from the rest of the world, where they can be together
and that's
without
the cabin
distraction.
In the woods.
That's right. Yeah. It was a fictional version of the Little North Fork River, which is east
on
of Salem.
Yeah,
that's right.
About 25 miles or so east.
That's
of Salem.
Right. That's right. So I was, you know, I spent a lot of time there with my family when my kiddo was young, and we would hike that trail along the Little North Fork. And at one point, when my wife and I were first living in Salem, we saw a little ad for an A-frame cabin for sale on the river, and we had no money to buy it at the time, and it was way out of our range, but the fantasy just sparked for me. So there was a moment when I was just imagining the future, imagining, you know, what would happen if we had bought that cabin, and then imagining like, oh, if we bought that cabin, we would have been so financially strained, we probably wouldn't have stayed together. And then sort of imagining, okay, this character, after his marriage falls apart, he's got this cabin and he can't afford to live anywhere else. So he's just going to have to live there and commute into town. And that's really where the story took off for me.
Now, Trust Me was influenced by a book you love, and you talked about this at your recent Powell's Books event, Tove Janssen's The Summer Book. So that book is written in 22 vignettes, and it focuses also on a relationship, this time between a grandmother in Finland and her 6-year-old granddaughter. What struck you about the book and inspired you? Was it the structure, the relationship between the two characters?
There's so much there. And if you haven't read the book, I mean, I can't recommend it highly enough.
No, I haven't. I've just read the summary.
It's so beautiful. It's really become one of my favorites. When I first read it, I was just so struck by the seeming simplicity of it, that it, on the surface, it seems so easy. This just the intense focus on these two characters. There's like a fairy tale, childlike, whimsical quality to it, and it's magical. And what I really ended up loving about it was partly the structure of these vignettes and how much she's able to accomplish in, you know, five to eight pages, and take us through a whole range of emotional registers. And then the relationship between these two characters and the place. And then there's a subtext of grief that runs all the way through, that there's a loss that's mentioned once on the 8th or 9th page of the book, and it is never mentioned again, but it undergirds everything.
But it kind of lingers.
It's just, it is what the book is about. It's, you know, how do people continue on after some great loss? And then how do they connect with each other and with this place that is slightly separate from the rest of the world? So, you know, I'm wanting to imitate or, you know, borrow whatever I could from the writers I love. I thought at first, you know, what's my magical place? What's my island in the Finnish sea? I haven't spent any time there. I don't have any other islands, but I did have the woods and I had that river. And so that's really where the initial impulse came from.
again, we mentioned it's written in 22 vignettes, and that's a form that very much appeals to you, especially as a short story writer. Your first novel, which I read and loved, I actually just kind of picked it up and I couldn't put it down. It was one of those. I just got involved right away. It's also written somewhat in that way, short chapters without an overarching plot. And it takes place 20 years over the course of, well, actually a guy a little bit like Lewis, who marries into a family, a divorced woman he marries, and she has two kids. Now, in an interview you did for Paper Brigade, which is a Jewish literary journal, you say that your own experience mirrors that structure. You see life in fragments. You use the term, which I love, moments that compile over time rather than a single narrative arc, which is something that you can't really see yourself doing, right. You know, extending a plot over 200, 400 pages.
Every time I try, it almost instantly feels artificial to me. And so I have been so drawn to the short story because of that. I feel like my life is not novelistic. And I think some people's lives are, and they think novelistically and they see patterns in those big arcs. For me, it's always feels like moment by moment. And we have these flashes that we sort of hang on to and thinking about a life. And I guess I'm also drawn to writing about characters whose lives are not overly dramatic and finding the mystery and the strangeness in the very ordinary. And so that first book, Between You and Me, the character, Paul Haberman, is about us. You know, I thought of him as, you know, as the ultimate nebbish. You know, there's, there's nothing really that he has going on except an appealingly rich inner life, despite the very placid surface. And so, his biography is much more based on my father's life. So he's 40 in 1980 and 60 when the book ends in 2001, I think. It's sort of 81 to 2001. But he's very much, I think I see myself in him more than I see anybody else, and somebody who's living a pretty routine life, not a lot of flash to it, but has a lot going on inside, I hope. And that was what was really appealing to me about writing about him.
Now, going back to the vignettes, you said, and I forget if it was it Powell's or in one of the interviews I read, that one of the very first novels in history, Don Quixote, is basically written in vignettes, an episodic novel, you called it, rather than a single narrative arc over hundreds of pages. And you said that was also an influence, but also maybe a green light for you to go ahead and write your own novel in vignettes, I'm on the right track here. If Cervantes can do it, I should get away with it too.
Yeah, I think that, that one, especially for the first novel, was a big influence. I really thought about that novel as Don Quixote in the New Jersey suburbs. Then if I could, sort of imagine that episodic quality that you're going to see. If you just watch this character over time long enough, you're going to see interesting patterns. And that's, I think, what's wonderful about Quixote is seeing him, move through these different phases of his life. And you don't need necessarily one big plot structure in order to enjoy that narrative and that story.
You also mentioned another book, which I found really interesting. This was an interview, Scott, you did with Oregon Arts Watch, The Frog and Toad Books by Arnold LaBelle. And you say that Trust Me is basically Frog and Toad for adults. And you said it was a book that you loved as a kid and you've read to your daughter.
I love those Frog and Toad books. And I love them as a kid. And I hadn't really thought about them again until my kiddo was young and read all of those multiple times. And I think they're such intricately structured character studies and studies of a relationship and a friendship, and they're hilarious and they're so simple. I mean, made for people to be able to read them when they first start reading, but doing an enormous amount with so few words. I'm quite taken with them, and I actually revisited with a more critical eye. I even taught a little class on the vignette novel and started by having us look at a couple of chapters of Frog and Toad and seeing what they could accomplish. And then comparing that with a summer book, and Evan S. Connell's Mrs. Bridge is another favorite. And Gwendolyn Brooks' novel, Maud Martha, is another favorite vignette novel. And we looked at those together, and you can just learn so much about the structure, even just looking at those Frog and Toad.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the Powell's event where you had one of your students, maybe he was in that class, Matt Young, and he had a novel that he when you launched Trust Me, he read from his novel, End of Active Service, which he said is also written in vignettes. And he also said he was having all sorts of trouble making the vignettes cohere at first. And he credited you, Scott, for helping him structure the book, for finding a way to make it work. What did you tell him? Was there a key? Was there some kind of...
I think he probably gives me more credit than I deserve, honestly. We had great conversations that year. I was his... during his MFA at the Rainier Writing Workshop, I was his first mentor during his first year. And he had already published his memoir, which is in vignettes and is an incredible book, Eat the Apple. And he was thinking, well, I did vignettes for that first novel, the first memoir. I think then maybe I'd do the same with the novel. And he was trying that out. And there was something that felt a little stifled for him. You know, he's like, there was too much compression. It did not enough room to breathe. And
he actually called them, rather than vignettes, flash fiction.
That's right. That's right. They were these little flashes. And so I think I encourage him to let them breathe a little bit more and not overly impose a structure that he had in mind, that if that structure wasn't serving the book, it was okay to, you know, if one of the vignettes, for example, just started growing bigger, just let it breathe, let it go. And I think that maybe helped him, let go of the preconceived ideas
of what he had to do.
That's right.
What he had in mind, and he can be a little freer.
And then I at the end of his second year in the program, he did a reading for our graduation, and by then it had exploded. So what happened between working with me, and then he worked with a great writer named Kent Myers for his second year, and I think Kent helped him open it up even more. And he found that first person voice, that structure was no longer necessary, and that the voice actually allowed him to carry it. And it's much less, vignettes now, and more of a really sort of deep, penetrating internal exploration of PTSD and a soldier's life after returning. Yes.
Yeah, I really enjoyed his reading. I haven't read the book yet, but I intend to. Now, Trust Me is written in 52 chapters or vignettes. And it focuses on the relationship between Lewis Nelson, he's a recently divorced father, and his seventh grade daughter, Skye. And it follows them from the fall of one year into the late summer of the next, with each chapter taking place on the weekend when Skye goes to live with her dad in his cabin in the Oregon woods just east of Salem on the Little North Fork. You started work on Trust Me, I think you've said, about 10 years ago. What was your initial vision for the novel?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when I first started, I already had the summer book in mind. So
at that mystical place.
I had the place, and I thought small sections made sense to me as if a way to try to explore this. And it was soon after my first novel came out, so I had that episodic, structure kind of already in my blood a little bit. But then I kept getting stuck over and over again, and then I did let go of that idea, that preconceived idea, and I just thought I'd just going to try to write about these characters for as long as I can and see where they take me. And I got a certain way in each time, and I felt like my starting place kept containing a full experience, and I couldn't see my way past it. And I thought, maybe this is just a short story. And I took three or four of the, maybe five of the initial chapters.
Oh, and turned them into a short story.
And combined them into a short story.
And you published that in one of your collections.
I did publish that.
What was the story name?
It's also called Trust Me.
Uh-huh.
So at that point, a lot of the main themes were there. These two characters trying to figure each other out, trust each other. But it was contained within a single, actually the very first chapter, this sort of single moment when Lewis has to bring Skye to school on a Monday morning, and he can't find his keys. And it turns out he left them in the door. He's trying to get out the door. Exactly. And Skye, and then we shift from his perspective and see a couple of moments from Skye's perspective of that weekend that just happened. And the story ends. He finds the keys, but then Skye runs down to the river. She's not ready to leave it yet and needs to say goodbye. And just his recognition that she may not appreciate him, but at least she's starting to appreciate the place, and it feels like maybe they've moved somewhere new. And I thought that was it. I thought, okay, I've gotten somewhere. It's a story. I like the story. Publish the story. But the characters didn't leave me alone. And then it was when those woods that I love so much got scorched by the Labor Day fires in fall of 2020, when I finally realized, oh, I know where this book goes. I didn't want it to go there, but that's where it maybe was heading inevitably all along, and I just had to wait for the ending to present itself. And after that point, I mean, I've been thinking about them for so long. I think that's part of it.
You had the characters.
I had been living with them for...
You had their voices in your head, too.
For years by then. And so I just knew how they saw the world and how they thought of each other, talked to each other. And then the rest of it came out really fast, faster than I could really believe. 6 months and the full draft was done. And it's faster than I've ever written anything. And it took me quite by surprise.
So I don't know how much to say in regards to spoilers, but the story didn't have the same ending, of course, as the novel. And the novel, even though we've talked about, doesn't have this overarching plot or narrative arc, it does have a climactic event.
Yeah.
And that's what kind of bonds them further, and that's what you were inspired by the Labor Day fire 2020.
Yeah, I think in the end, what I didn't need a plot, but I did need something to move them in a new direction, a new place, and... It gave momentum to the full story and gave urgency to figure out what do they really have at stake. And I thought, well, what they have at stake is their relationship with each other, which really is maybe the most important thing. Can they really find each other, be present to each other? But they also, the stakes with the place were the thing that was maybe missing for me.
And she falls in love with it, which you wouldn't necessarily think a preteen would do.
Right.
She's also isolated from the internet, from television. It barely gets a signal for cell phone service.
And she complains about it a lot, but also I think she discovers how much she needs it and that it feeds her in a similar way that it does her father.
Now, most of the book, as we've said, takes place on the Little North Fork in the cabin on these weekends with Skye and Lewis. There are scenes also in Salem where Skye lives during the week with her mom and goes to middle school. I think Lewis works there for the Oregon Department of Transportation and Communications. And even one chapter takes place in Portland. There's another one where Lewis's parents come out and take her to the Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, The Merchant of Venice, and they get into the question of Jews in Shakespeare's work.
Right.
And also, when they go to Portland, he takes her to Powell's Books, out for pizza, and they see The Lion King, which I imagine they did at the Keller Auditorium.
Right.
And you're well acquainted with both Salem and where you teach now and live, and Portland, where you lived when you first arrived. So I just love seeing all this, all part of your love letter to Oregon in there.
Yeah, it was fun to write those scenes. I knew there needed to be enough variation. You can only do so much with a cabin in the woods. And there's a lot of cliche that can happen with it if it's just reverence for the natural world. And I think the part of the reverence for the natural world comes through contrast. I love cities. I've always loved living in cities, being in cities, and I love Portland still. But for these characters to be able to have their special space together, separate, to really see it in its full flourishing, I think I needed scenes that took place in both of those cities. And Lewis's job is, the most tedious thing possible, and he really doesn't care about it much at all. And so part of it is his life in the cabin is an escape from that. But also, I mean, I love Salem. I've lived there now for going on, I think, since 2008. So it's 16 years now, which is hard to believe. And it is a strange little capital city, but it's got some great things going for it. And just seeing some of these spaces that I spend time in, especially as a parent, so I have a scene that takes place at North Salem High School waiting for a theater camp to come out, which is
how I have spent High School Musical.
Yeah, I've spent my last several summers, standing on that lawn waiting for my kiddo to get out of the theater camp and imagining Lewis, flirting with one of the other parents there. And it was really fun for me to write those scenes almost as much as writing the ones in the woods.
Yeah, another a scene or vignette that I really loved was when it was called Father's Day, the chapter, and Lewis takes Skye to Oregon's Enchanted Forest, which you describe in the book as a tiny amusement park just south of Salem and built in the 1970s by a lunatic who loved kids and European fairy tales, and they have these creepy mechanized figures there, too. I remember taking my kids there and was so happy to see in the book because you get to share what you call in the book also Skye's childish glee. Yeah. which I saw it through my kids' eyes. And all of a sudden, you know, it wasn't this rundown amusement park anymore, this kind of, I don't know, budget Disneyland.
I love that place so much. We go every summer. It's at least 10 years running. And the first time I actually went was when I was a graduate student at Oregon State. My teacher, Marjorie Sandor, was teaching a class on myth and American fiction. And as a field trip, the whole class took her 5-year-old or 6-year-old daughter to the Enchanted Forest. And just as a way to think about kitsch and think about myth and how do Americans sort of recreate these
right,
myths.
Right, the Disneyfication of, say, Grimm's fairy tales,
absolutely,
for example. Something
absolutely.
Like they take out all the good parts.
Yeah, yeah. And the Enchanted Forest has enough creepiness to make it real, to feel genuine. And it's such a blast. So that was one of my favorites. And we ride on the log flume every year, which is
Lewis and Skye do in the book.
Right. And it's really terrifying. My wife refuses to go on it anymore, but I still do it. And every time I'm like, why have I agreed to do this? And it's a blast. So that was one of my favorite chapters to write.
Now, Lewis in the book grew up Jewish in New Jersey and attended college in North Carolina, as you did. His last name is Nelson. And I couldn't help but think that's basically Nadelson without the A and the D. From reading your work, Scott, and your interviews, I know you're a very careful writer, especially when it comes to names. So I'm sure this was deliberate on your part and a way of connecting yourself connecting the character to the author.
For sure. There's a lot that's different about Lewis than I am. But I think of him as one of my, you know, a darker twin, you know, or sort of like a sloppier twin in this case. And it was a little bit of a wink in there because my middle name is Lewis. And actually my grandmother.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
My grandmother, my paternal grandmother's maiden name was Nelson. And my kiddo's name is Iona, which is, you know, an island in Scotland.
I want to ask you about that because I know Iona through, was Skye in the book.
Mm-hmm.
There's an actress, Ione Skye.
Right, right.
Her father, I looked it up. Her father is actually Donovan. Donovan Leach,
the
famous
right.
folk singer. He
yeah.
did Mellow Yellow and
right.
Atlantis and a number of other songs back in the 60s. And I wondered, is that something deliberate too? You say in the book she was named, in the book, Skye was named after the island
right.
in Scotland. And of
right.
course, Ione Skye was also, it's actually her middle name, her last name's Leach.
Right.
She was also named after that island because her dad, Donovan, was Scottish.
Right.
Was and that so something you had in mind?
It was. Not Donovan and Ione Skye necessarily, but you know, I had lived in Scotland and the Isle of Skye was one of my favorite places. And we named our kiddo Iona kind of on a whim, thinking somebody described for us they had just visited the island of Iona, which I had never gotten to when I lived there. And I wanted to, and I was close. I went to the island of Mull, which is right next to it. But there was a tour of the Oban Distillery that was going to happen.
Oh, yeah, single malt scotch.
And so I chose, I'll get to Iona another time. I got to go to the distillery instead. So there was something about, you know, that's a place of you know, magic and beauty and longing, but it's also a place you can't quite get to. And so I think I describe in the book that they name her Skye after an island that they hoped one day to visit, not that they had actually been there. So that
right.
was, yeah, that was my little wink, you know, sort of a nod to my own experience.
Now, Lewis himself, I read Between You and Me before I read Trust Me, is somewhat similar to Paul Haberman, who we mentioned as the main character in Between You and Me, also Jewish. Paul Haberman's a New Yorker, though living in New Jersey when the story takes place. Paul also has this challenging relationship with his wife and his children, who are his stepchildren, his divorced wife's kids, and use the word somewhat of a nebbish, like Lewis. But nebbish also, I looked it up, it's actually Yiddish. It comes from the Yiddish for poor thing.
Right.
But still, nebbishes are good, loving, trustworthy men, maybe not necessarily virile and adept,
right.
as some guys want to be, your toxic masculinity. And that describes a lot. I'm East Coast Jew, too, so I guess I'm nebbishy, too. I wouldn't deny it. What appeals to you about characters like Lewis and Paul?
You know, I think I'm just always looking for characters, or maybe just what comes out naturally, are characters who are carrying on the surface a lot of a lot of obvious flaws, but then have some inner dignity and sort of trying to find the dignity there. I think Lewis is a little more hip than Paul Haberman, for sure. He was, you know, he sort of sees himself in a different kind of masculine way as sort of the Gen X slacker, you know, spent a lot of time at rock clubs and has a lot of cool friends with lots of tattoos. And, you know, but he's also, he's a lot softer on the inside than what he might want to present on the outside.
And, yeah, it's funny what he wants to present, because he and his daughter both share a love of the cabin, of course, the woods and the river and the nature surrounding them. He fly fishes in the book, though he never catches anything.
Right.
I think that was deliberate. I just don't remember. I think his father comes out and catches a little rainbow trout or something, which Lewis falls on and smushes or something.
Yeah.
Total nebbish, right?
Lewis never catches a thing that we see. You know, he may hear about him catching things when Sky's not around. In the end, for him, fishing is just being out there and being present to the place. And I don't fish anymore. I fished when I was a kid and loved it.
Where in New Jersey?
In New Jersey.
That's funny.
Yeah,
I grew up in New York, and the only fish I got close to was gefilte fish.
Right.
A Sunday morning.
Yeah, no, in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, where we had a little summer place for a few years, and I fished a lot. But then I became vegetarian in college, and so I haven't fished since, and now I forage for mushrooms. That's my, you know, my fishing, vegetarian fishing.
Oh, okay, because Lewis does that too. And I actually learned a few things. There's one I hadn't heard of called the bolete. Right. And Lewis calls that the prize of the woods. Really good eating.
You would know it as a porcini, you know.
Oh, porcini mushroom.
That's the same thing.
Yeah,
the king bolete is a porcini, and they're the best.
As a vegetarian, they make porcini burgers.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then also morels, which are also delicious and in great demand. What was interesting in the book, and I didn't know, is they grow around dead or dying trees. So there seems to be a metaphor in there, like a burnt out ground. Yeah. That's where this amazing mushroom grows from the ruins.
Absolutely, yeah. And the morel, especially, is a fire mushroom, and I'm torn about it because, you know, I have deliberately tried to actually avoid going to fire scars to look for morels because I don't want to root for destruction, right? As much as I love those mushrooms, but I did a few years ago walk through on a trail that went through a burn area and found piles and piles of them. And there is something beautiful about, you know, the reason that they fruit when it burns is they need to spread their spores and get them, you know, they have such a symbiotic relationship with the trees that they don't need to send up spores as long as the trees are alive. They do perfectly well as mycelium. And then when those trees burn, they need to get their spores out. So there's something beautiful about the regeneration, but there's also something a little uncomfortable about sort of wanting to prey on that destruction, and which I think I reference in the book that, you know, Europeans used to deliberately burn their forests in order to have a good morel crop, which is, you know, in certain parts of Europe you go to and they're totally deforested, and you can
imagine
why.
Yeah, that's taking it to the other extreme.
Exactly.
But here it's in the book, you said you were inspired by the Labor Day fire of 2020. Right. So I think it gives the reader, when they're reading about morels, they have some hope that from this destruction will come something good at some point.
Yeah, some kind of renewal. And of course, fires are so necessary for the landscape, and they have been for centuries. And certain trees only sprout after fires. But of course, the fires we're having now are not natural ones, and they're so destructive. And so there's balance
and
there.
It's from a man-made phenomena.
Absolutely.
Climate change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's not usual. And today it's 98 degrees in Portland, a record day for September.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that recognizing, I mean, we can believe in the renewal and the cleansing power of fire up to a point. and then it also will just take everything you got. And those Labor Day fires, I mean, they didn't leave much. They burned so hot that it's taking things a lot longer to regrow than what a normal fire might do.
And rather than talking about all the tragedy there and the climactic event in the book and the Labor Day fire, there's a lot of comedy in the book too. It's funny. And some of that comes through, I think what we were talking about, Lewis as an Ebbish or somebody who has an idea of what a man should do in the woods, and he's just not quite capable. At one point, he tries to build a stone path for Skye, never gets finished. He tries to build a box to protect his firewood. That's a disaster. I think termites get into it. So there's comedy that comes out of that. And also, I think, and it must be from your life with your daughter, the dialogue between them both is just so real and funny. They're getting to know each other. They are who they are. And Skye just seems to have a fun time kind of baiting her dad at times. I don't know if Iona did that with you.
Well, you know, when I was writing the book, Iona was a lot younger. Now they do that all the time. And they have... I mean, I think even a sharper wit than I could have even imagined when they were 4 years old, when I started writing the book. I think the dialogue and the banter just kind of came out naturally, imagining this relationship and these characters. And it was just pleasure writing this back and forth. I love writing dialogue because it's got it's the way that characters want to present themselves on externally. It's their most public face, but it also hides so much of what's under the surface, and it's pretty quickly you start to read it into what they're not saying. So it's always fun to write, and it always provides opportunities for some conflict, but then also I think the comedy just came out of who these characters were and their way of seeing each other. One of my favorite moments to write was when they have a battle over the game of Risk. and I think one of my favorite lines was, you know, when Skye shouts, you know, expel the colonizers. And the whole game is about colonizing, you know. So the irony of that was just so much fun. I couldn't resist writing some of those lines.
Now I want to talk about the title. So trust me, you've had previous books. We talked about your first novel, Between You and Me, a short story collection called One of Us. So you tend to get pronouns in the title, but also, why trust me? When I hear it, when somebody says, trust me, automatically you don't. Right. I mean, politicians say all the time, believe me, trust me. And you say, okay, you BS meter.
Right. Right. I think it really captured the essence of that relationship to me it's what these characters really need from each other in the end, is to figure out how to trust each other. But there's a lot of a question about whether that's a wise idea, especially at the beginning of the book. And especially, you know, when it comes to Skye trusting her dad, because he is pretty hapless. And, you know, when they first are foraging for mushrooms, they find this King Bolete, but she references the year before when he, you know, ate a bunch of false chanterelles and made himself sick for 3 days. And so he says, trust me, this is great. I'm like 99% sure. And then he says, well, you know, 97% sure, but we'll make sure. And so there's constantly this back and forth of, you know, how much they should or can trust each other. And one of the early chapters I wrote that ended up being in that short story was a chapter that I've called Trust in here. And it takes place one of the weekends. It's raining, and out of boredom, Skye teaches her father to do some yoga. And in her yoga class, they always end with an exercise, a trust exercise, where one person closes their eyes and the other person walks them around the room.
Oh, I remember that chapter, yes.
Keeping them from walking into furniture. And she gets distracted and walks her dad into a bookshelf. And so that sort of, you know, notion of how much do you trust, how much do you trust yourself to take care of the other person? And in the end, I mean, they can protect each other only so much. The world is a difficult place, but if they can give over to each other a little bit and just trust that they'll be there for each other, I think that's really what the book ended up being about more than anything else.
Well, you did such a good job of setting that up with Lewis and the mushrooms, and then Skye and the yoga and walking her dad into the furniture, which is my initial impression of when somebody says, trust me. Right. But then they learn they really have to trust each other. She enjoys the cabin of the woods. He's been divorced just about a year, so he's kind of getting used to it. But even getting divorced from the mom, and it's almost a way of abandoning Skye. So over the next year, which where the book takes place, they kind of are coming from this place, but they have to learn to trust each other and to bond rather than to let things go in the opposite direction where they just move farther and farther away. And then by the end of the book, I don't think I'm giving too much away. That trust becomes almost a matter of survival.
Yeah, I think that's a really nice way of describing what ended up happening. And you know, as I was writing the book, I knew that that was the risk, is that they could easily drift away. That Skye, early in the book, acknowledges and recognizes that her love for her mother is unconditional and easy, and her love for her father is not. It's, you know, she worries that, you know, one day she'll wake up and she doesn't love him in the same way, or and that she could easily drift away from him. And Lewis feels that pretty early on too. And as I was writing, I really didn't know, are they going to, in my short stories, it would probably be more natural for them actually to be more distant. I think there's a darker turn. I somehow, maybe the novel, if you're going to live with these characters for this long, you couldn't, it wouldn't hold together as a narrative if they just drifted apart.
Well, was it a case, Scott, where writers will say this, where the characters at a certain point take over and they tell you where they want to go?
It did kind of feel that way to me. There was an inevitability that they move through different stages as the seasons go on. And part of it, they get involved in their own lives and they're doing their own thing and then they're just existing together. And so there's maybe a little less direct urgency that they have to take care of each other. And it's maybe through that, just being present with each other while living their own lives, that they stop worrying about whether they should trust each other or not, and they just start doing it.
It becomes natural.
Yeah, and then they really do need each other by the end.
And that's like climactic event.
Exactly. Exactly.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, which I really don't believe in spoilers too much. So I, you know, it's okay.
I think you probably gave it away at Powell's.
I did. Yeah. And Iona keeps telling me I shouldn't tell people what happens at the end, but you know, I feel like it was a part of it.
I think so too. I don't think it ruins the book at all for anybody to know. Now, as mentioned, there are 52 chapters or vignettes in the book, and they're all taking place a different weekend over the year, from fall through late summer. The point of view in each chapter alternates between Lewis and Skye, father and daughter. And I was wondering, why did you structure it this way? And the other question I had on that was, even though the point of view, it's close third person, why not first person to actually have them narrating their own story, their own vignette?
It's a great question. I think, point of view is always such an interesting choice that writers make. It really is the fundamental choice that dictates what the narrative is actually about. So it's, you know, it's where you're placing your readers in relationship to the characters. First person to me is so much about the way that a character articulates their own inner life. And there's an intimacy to that, but there's also built-in delusion, right? Because characters can only see themselves so well. And I actually find that close third-person point of view
More objective.
It's the most penetrating, that you can fully inhabit the character. You can
see
their inner life
from like above.
You can see them outside
their head.
You can see them inside, and you can see the parts of themselves that they won't even acknowledge, right? That I actually think you can go deeper in their inner lives than they can in first person often.
I can see that if Lewis narrated his own chapters, it'd be very different. He would see himself as this kind of great woodsman, right?
Yeah, he really couldn't see himself as clearly as an outside narrator, right? Or even as clear as his daughter sees him. And so I think I knew pretty early on that I wanted both of their perspectives, and moving naturally between them, you know, as that vignette structure came together, it was pretty organic pretty early on to move back and forth from one to the next.
Now, we mentioned climate change, and of course we mentioned it based on the weather today. It's not really natural for Portland, and it's been like this for a few summers now. It's an underlying theme in the book. Lewis and Skye bond through that climactic event, one that's a result of climate change that has them depending on each other for survival. That's probably the most dramatic reference in the book, but in one chapter, there's one called Emissions. Skye's writing a report on the subject and blames her father and his generation for climate change. She shows him a picture of an emaciated polar bear because the ice caps are melting and the polar bear can't find food. And she wants her dad to go green and buy an electric car. He's not quite ready to commit to that. So she can feel, in the woods, she can see, feel, and just sense what she has to lose. It's not like if I just picked up a book or looked on the internet and saw this emaciated polar bear. If I was in the woods here and I fell in love with it, and I knew this really is what the stakes are. So it becomes personal for her. And I really enjoyed the way you did that in the book. It's not theoretical anymore. It's her experience.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's hard for me to think about writing directly about something so challenging and so large as climate change.
And yet it seems to me a necessity for almost every writer.
We have to figure out how we reckon with the world we're in, right? And so for me, it's always comes through the particulars and the particular characters and how these characters are dealing with their world. And I see my kiddos' generation, it's so different. And there's all kinds of statistics about their, there's a hopelessness sort of built into their worldview that's, I don't think was present when we were, when I was a kid in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, so. You have to pair that with school shootings and a number of other events, what's happening with politics now.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like there's going to be much of a future.
Yeah, so I think it was really a matter of just trying to stay true to this character and the character's perspective. And Lewis, also, of course, recognizes what's happening in the world, but he just wants to stick his head in the sand. He can't really deal with it.
Like most of us.
And so it was trying to force him to see what's in front of him and also, really recognize Skye's emotional life in the way that she's reckoning with, just her regular school life and friends, but also what's happening in the world around her. And those things are always coming in from all directions.
Trust Me is published by one of Portland's independent presses, Forest Avenue, run by the wonderful Laura Stanfill. And you've published books with another local press, Hawthorne Books, led by the equally wonderful Rhonda Hughes. How'd you connect with Laura for Trust Me, who's not just a publisher, but an incredible writer and editor? And what's been your experience as the author working with her?
Oh, I feel so lucky to have worked with both of those presses. I mean, Rhonda is incredible force of nature, and Laura is equally so. And
yeah, aren't we fortunate in Portland to have them both?
And Laura, so I've known Laura for a while. She, I think, first reached out to me some years ago with one of her early titles to write a blurb for Stephen Allred's a wonderful book of short stories, the Renata stories, which I really
right.
love.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I interviewed for An Ale House at the End of the World, novel.
I also read is wonderful. So I had known about the press, and then she had an open call for submissions, and I had tried shopping the book around to some agents, and most people were not that interested. It didn't have a big plot engine, but I thought, Forest Avenue, I mean, this could make a lot of sense for Laura.
Forest is in the title.
Yeah, and Pacific Northwest setting. She does a lot of Pacific Northwest work, and she's so good at connecting with Pacific Northwest independent booksellers. I thought, I'll just give it a shot. So I sent it in to their open call, and they had whatever their process was, and took a couple months, and she reached out, and it's been amazing to work with her. So she's so energetic, and really just, I mean, one of the pleasures of working with small presses, especially independent presses that don't have a university behind them. I've worked with some nice university presses as well, but independent presses, they have to believe in their books 100%, right? They're trying
to support their authors, not just kind of go do it yourself.
They're only doing a few a year, right? Uh-huh. So it's not like we won't worry about this book because we have these other 20 books we can try to push, or we have this one really big title we're going to try to push. So they have to try to push everything, and they have to believe, fully in each book, and to feel that behind you, have a very small readership, and that's okay with me, but it's really nice to know that, you have some people who really believe in what you're doing.
And you'll be traveling with her this weekend to the Sisters Festival of Books.
That's right.
You'll be appearing together there.
That's right. We'll be in conversation in Sisters, which I'm very much looking forward to.
And that's Sisters, Oregon, for people who don't know. So again, you have this love letter to our state. Now, Scott, one last question. You said after your struggles on Trust Me, you're writing novel and vignettes, taking 10 years, putting it aside, taking it up again after the Labor Day fire. You're now working on short stories, mercifully, for you. Yeah. Very short stories as kind of a palate cleanser.
It has been, yeah. I've been working on a number of different things. I have some longer stories, and there's a novella kicking around, but most recently, I started this series of very short pieces that's been so much fun to work on.
Would it be flash fiction? I don't even know how that's defined.
Yeah, I don't love that term. I think of them as miniature stories, and they're maybe not as short as what people would consider flash. Some of them are very short, but they're They're trying. I was actually thinking about a single sitting stories. So a story you can read in a single sitting, and a story that I could draft in a single sitting. In the end, I don't know that I, you know, I've been revising and revising. So as many sittings by the time the stories are actually done, but it was a story I could sit down on. What story am I going to tell myself today? And I started it right around my 50th birthday. And I told myself I was going to write 50 of these, you know, I'm going to tell myself a story for 50 times this year. And I ended up writing 51 by accident. My working title right now is 51 Ways to Fail. They're all meditations on failure of various kinds. And it's been a blast.
Characters in common with some of the fictions in there?
There are some that are very, very autobiographical. So there's a kind of first person that maybe you'll see reappear in different places. But otherwise, they're less connected. There are some that are formally connected. So I have a series that are called overheard conversations that are just dialogues that are, there's overheard at the river, overheard at the lake, overheard in the library. And so there was something really freeing about the form. I just got to experiment and play a lot more, and we'll see what happens with it, but I'm having a good time right now.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for talking with us today, and thanks so much for this beautiful book.
Thank you, Ken. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show or just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Scott Nadelson, author of the new novel, Trust Me, from Portland's Forest Avenue Press. Scott will be at the Sisters Festival of Books in Sisters, Oregon, of all places, this Saturday, September 14th. He'll also be reading at the Salem Poetry Project on September 19th and in Corvallis on October 4th for Magic Barrel, a reading to fight hunger. You can find out more about Scott, his work, and all his upcoming events online at scottnadelson.com. Just a note that KBOO is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. We're in the middle of our fall membership drive, so there's no better time to show your support for the station and programming like this by becoming a member yourself or renewing your membership. Just go online to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month, now officially from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, September 26th at 10:30 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying hope to see you all again then.